Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Minute past the hour, and yea, verily, lo and behold, Friday on the front porch is here. Or, because I had a conversation with our friend on Twitter, Birch Cello Wren, who said sometimes the information contained in any given week's broadcast of the Horn leaves her running right past the idea of Friday on the front porch to Friday in the fetal position. And I told her right away I was stealing that. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you'll find the entrance to the chat room, which is quickly filling up. No, it's not filling up. It has virtually unlimited capacity. Jump right in. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com/chatroom. You'll also find the Listen Live button. That's handy if you're sitting around a PC device or something. On the other hand, if you are using a mobile device, a tablet, and a smart device, we recommend the apps from TuneIn Radio and Stitcher. Free and easy, although the pay versions offer a couple of more bells and whistles. Please to note, any advertisements you hear running thereon are not advertisements for which the Horn is paid. That's just how they keep themselves going, not us. As such, I'll mention that we are trying to close out the week on an even keel, and that leaves us at this point in time needing to raise $280 this evening. That's 28 folks, 10 bucks apiece, two folks at 140, four people at 70, and on with the gazintas and the ciphering. So if you want to run by the PayPal button and hit it, that's wonderful. If you want to just shoot me a note and say, hey, tell boss man Wayne there won't be an echo in the mailbox, if you prefer to use traditional mail methods, that's cool, too. The address, of course, being The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801. That's how we keep all of this going. No ads for Buy Gold Now, none of that. Just the gritty determination of people who enjoy independent media to see that independent media continues. And no, we don't send out blast emails to thousands of people saying, by golly, we've only got 2 days to raise $20,000 for this quarter. Nope, not that either. Yeah, we try to raise $150 an evening. When we fall behind, it all adds together, and that means, yeah, $280 this evening. And thanks to Sal, and thanks to Kevin for getting us started this evening. Thank you very, very much. It is Friday on the front porch, and I think we've got a good bit of conversation to engage in. Another little reminder, I will be, and I'm tickled. I'm thrilled. I'm honored to have a chance to engage in ongoing discussion about the West Virginia water disaster this Sunday on the Melissa Harris Perry Show on MSNBC. And I thank them very kindly for the offer, and I hope I can do it and do y'all proud. It'll be the final segment about the 11:30 portion of the program in the Eastern time zone. If you don't have cable, it will be available online post-show, I do believe. And there's still a lot to talk about with the ongoing water disaster. And if you look at some of the other disasters that are rolling around out there, you begin to see a few common threads. Generally, it involves not a terrorist, not a 6-foot-6-inch tall Arab trailing a portable dialysis machine. No, it involves well-heeled men and occasionally women in Wall Street wear who talk a lot about the free market and who talk even more about profits and wind up poisoning people so that they can have a better vacation in St. Lucia sometime next year. Yeah. So it's just worth thinking about. You know, instead of going right to the West Virginia, and by the way, when we talk, for anybody who's new to the process, when we talk about Friday on the Front Porch, we're talking about an all-around free-for-all conversation. Well, you know, sort of a radio roundtable, only not involving any pretense that we're anything but ordinary workaday folks who are capable of seeing obvious solutions to problems that are apparently baffling to the people in the Wall Street wear. Yeah. So we'll be firing up the Friday on the Front Porch conversation, here in about 54 minutes or so. We will have four lines open on the traditional telephone lines. 304-658-3333 is that number. Or if you would like to jump into the Horn Molloy Skype chat group, which will be the other side of Friday on the Front Porch, then send a contact request, if you haven't before, send a contact request on Skype to Sparky Dunk, S-P-A-R-K-Y-D-U-N-C, Sparky Dunk, that is the indefatigable Sparky, who is also a moderator in the Horn chat room, and we'll see if we can't get you hooked up to join in the Friday on the Front Porch conversation. Okay? Have we got all of that? Yeah. I'll be home on Sunday evening, so we should have a regular show on Monday. By the way, Dr. Bill, who spent this week visiting with his brother, who had driven down from Boston, and they had, I checked in with Dr. Bill, they had a magnificent time together. They running around being brothers out on the town. Dr. Bill will be back on Monday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. And then we'll pick up with more on Monday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time and have what I hope will be a normal broadcast week, to the extent that normal is anything more than a setting on a dryer. But as I said, we're going to jump over not first to the ongoing West Virginia water disaster, but instead to another water disaster. In this case, the water disaster that is unfolding along the Virginia-North Carolina border. The Duke Energy, oh my God, we have no idea what's going on here because we spent all our time worrying about profits and not people. Toxic coal ash disaster. I think it's time that we really do put away phrases like spill and accident, because these are not accidents. It is not an accident when a company spends all of its time and the majority of its focus chasing after profits and not nearly enough time ensuring that the toxins it produces do not wind up poisoning innocent human beings. That ain't no accident. It's not a flaw, it's a feature. No, it's a flaw. So you know that thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of tons, tens of thousands of tons of toxic coal waste dumped into the Dan River near the ironically named town of Eden, North Carolina. It is flowing downstream. It is flowing past public drinking water supplies. And, well, Duke Energy is, oh, we're not even sure what the pipe's made out of that's leaking. So, well, I mean, you know, oh, God, I guess the quarterly earnings are going to be off this quarter. Damn. Well, it was shortly after the close of the program last night that I got a note from News Ninja Gene, who reads the internet every day and therefore found the following. On November the 4th, 2009, Duke Energy lobbyist Bill Tindall walked into the White House, this is from Greenpeace, and met with Obama administration officials to discuss whether coal ash should be regulated in the wake of the TVA coal ash spill disaster that had happened 10 months previously. You might recall that was Kingston, Tennessee. You might recall that our good friend John Wathen, the Hurricane Creek Keeper from Alabama, was gracious enough to come on the program and tell us about what he had observed, because he was one of the first people to observe that disaster, had to run around evading TVA people, trying to keep people from finding out just exactly what was going on. I remember distinctly John Wathen talking about how there were ashbergs, not icebergs, ashbergs floating down the river there in December of 2008. And, of course, coal ash is deadly poison. It contains wild concentrations of nightmare elements from the heavy metals end of the periodic table. And it was all headed downstream, and some of it would sink into the riverbed along the way, thereby making the riverbed toxic. Well, guess what? 10 months after that happened, Duke Energy sent its lobbyist, Bill Tindall, toddling over to the White House to meet with the newfangled Obama president to say, pretty please, please, really, no, we don't need to regulate coal ash. Coal ash is good. I have it on my Wheaties every morning. Please make the EPA leave it alone. Bill Tindall was trying to delay implementation of EPA policies that would have, lo and behold, no kidding, prevented, as in kept from happening, this current Duke Energy poison water disaster. Greenpeace noting that EPA has essentially sat on its hands for the past 4 years, delaying the publication of a simple and common-sense rule that would label coal ash as hazardous waste and thereby force utilities like Duke Energy to clean up the mess they create when they burn coal. Here, a week into the process, the Dan River coal ash disaster has become the third largest coal ash spill in history, at least in the U.S. As of my last check-in, they have not stopped the leak yet. It's still going into the Dan River. And no, I was not kidding. Duke Energy, as of yesterday, said they, golly gee, just didn't know what the pipe was made out of. And when you don't know what the pipe that's burst is made out of, fixing the burst pipe becomes significantly more difficult, does it not? Meanwhile, the nearest town downstream, Danville, Virginia, has been relying on test results from Duke Energy, who would have absolutely no reason to dummy up the test results, now would they? Because we know that American corporations never, ever fib. There's only one problem. If you were checking out the New York Times, you noticed that samples that came from people who weren't Duke Energy, well, they showed levels of toxins, poisons, deadly chemicals, deadly heavy metal elements in the water at vastly increased amounts as compared to the samples taken by Duke Energy. Wonder why that is. Yeah. So in 2009, Mr. Tindall, lobbyist for Duke Energy, gets himself a meeting at the White House. P.S. Nobody working on the AIC Act, for instance, ACHEACT.org, has ever been able to get through the gates of the White House, because I guess we're just the wrong kind of people. Being as how we're just hillbillies who have to actually deal with these filthy messes, as opposed to well-heeled, well-paid lobbyists in $2,000 suits. Who know how to talk with their teeth clenched and call everybody babe. No, after that meeting, Duke Energy and some other coal burners, as well as the, and I remember the first time I found out that this thing even existed, having a pretty kind of, well, not entirely low-grade conniption, but it was certainly a conniption, having conniption on the air at the fact that there is really, no kidding, stab yourself in the neck with a Thorazine dart, an American Coal Ash Association. And it turned out that where coal ash was concerned, the American Coal Ash Association, Duke Energy et al., wound up getting to write every single publication from the Environmental Protection Agency regarding the topic of coal ash. This is good work, very good work by Greenpeace. David Pomerantz is the author. Duke Energy lobbied to delay coal ash safety policies that could have prevented Dan River spill. You can find it at greenpeaceblogs.org. But really, you know, all that time, all that air that was wasted, all that precious finite time that was flushed down the toilet with that stupid, cockamamie, ass-backward, idiotic argument that the Kenyan-Muslim Obama administration had the war on coal. It was pure, unmitigated coal ash. Because coal ash is worse than bullshit. As far as we can tell, what has been dumped into the Dan River so far by the fine folks at Duke Energy, better living through coal combustion, is equal to some 677 train cars worth of coal ash. That's a long train. That's a mighty long train. Jeebus. I mean, really. So, by playing their little corporate profiteering delay games, they kept the EPA rule from taking effect long enough for the 2012 presidential election cycle to get into full swing, which meant that everybody became terrified of talking about anything that would prevent people from being poisoned because of political ambition and because of the nature of a toxic our toxic political system. So there's that. Meanwhile, for anyone listening to this program who would happen to be in Georgia, Kentucky, South Carolina Stan, North Carolina Stan, Tennessee Stan, the old Dominion of Virginia, West Virginia, or Pennsylvania, the following is for you. On the West Virginia and Pennsylvania border, sometimes referred to as the Mason-Dixon line if it's the horizontal border, the vertical border is just the West Virginia panhandle. But on the West Virginia-Pennsylvania border, the Little Blue Run, Little Blue Run Coal Ash Pond is the very largest in the whole United States. Okay, oh, thank you, Isaac, via Twitter, just so you can figure out what 677 train carloads equals. 120 train cars equals a mile-long train. So 480 train cars is 4 miles. 5 miles is 600 train cars. Begin to get the idea of the scope of this problem? But anyway, the Little Blue Run Coal Ash Pond is the largest in the country, and it does not have signs saying, see poison from 7 states, visit Little Blue Run Coal Ash Pond. New. The Little Blue Run Coal Ash Pond covers 3 square miles. It's visible from space. It's troubled and troublesome. Then, over in the Old Dominion, Virginia, that job-killing EPA, the one that was co-opted by the American Coal Ash Association. Can you imagine that? I'm sorry, this is still just messing with me a little bit. Can you imagine that there are actual human beings who consider themselves our fellow Americans who get up and go to work every day at the American Coal Ash Association and sleep as soundly as any human being possibly can at the end of the day? A gentle reminder of the quote that I use for my signature line in my emails from my hero Kurt Vonnegut. A normal person functioning well on the upper levels of a prosperous industrialized society can hardly hear his conscience at all. Again, a normal person functioning well on the upper levels of a prosperous industrialized society can hardly hear his conscience at all. So every day, God knows how many people get up and go to work at the American Coal Ash Association and they do things to make coal ash more palatable or perhaps just less noticeable to the American people. Here's the fun part. The American Coal Ash Association was founded in 1968. They want you to believe that the American Coal Ash Association, established in 1968, is a non-profit trade association devoted to recycling the materials created when we burn coal to generate electricity. Our members comprise the world's foremost experts on coal ash, fly ash and bottom ash, and boiler slag, flue gas desulfurization, gypsum, FGD, or synthetic gypsum, and other flue gas materials captured by emissions controls. By the way, they're celebrating. There's a photograph on their website that says, Kingston Spill 5th Anniversary. Cleanup is complete, but work remains for beneficial use. Anybody want to channel the ghost of George Orwell and tell me what that actually means? Good God, they've even got a convention. It's they in 2013 they had the 2013 conference World of Coal Ash. Well, they are working on turning us into a world of coal ash, aren't they? But what's really bizarre is when you see their logo for it, it's a roughly spheroid object that has stopped being a combination of blue and green and has been transformed into blobs of yellow and purple and pink and deep blue and magenta and cyan and pink. Yeah, just like the world they're trying to create. They invite you to join them in Albuquerque. Aw, damn, it's already over. They had a big party in Albuquerque. You know, I knew I should have taken that left lane. Oh, for heaven's sakes. Who gets up every day, for instance, and goes to work and receives a Laurel and Hardy handshake, not to mention a tasty paycheck, for being involved with the American Coal Ash Association and all the poisoning that has taken place because the American Coal Ash Association worked hammer and tongs hand over fist to make sure that more people got poisoned? Well, that would be Thomas Adams, executive director. Yeah. Yeah, Thomas Adams, or member liaison Elisa Barlow, or David Goss, ACAA advisor and consultant. What in the hell does that mean? Or John Ward, communications coordinator. That's the staff. And those are the folks who helped make it possible for the Duke Energy Eden, North Carolina Dan River spill to happen. But anyway. In the Old Dominion, Virginia, that job-killing EPA has only inspected 5 out of 13 power plants for purposes of ascertaining whether or not their coal ash toxic waste ponds and dams holding back same are safe. 5 out of 13 ain't bad. Well, okay, let's play Dungeons and Dragons and get out the 13-sided die. And you know what? The ogre only comes and chops your head off if you roll a 1 through 5. Or maybe they were determined to be safe enough. Maybe the ogre comes and chops your head off if you get 6 through 13. I don't know. Maybe it depends on whether you're a neutral, evil member of the American Coal Ash Association and you're playing Dungeons and Dragons. It's hard to say. And then there's Tennessee. East Tennessee. Well, no, actually, all of Tennessee. East Tennessee is where they still do mountaintop removal, but Tennessee has plenty of coal-fired power plants. It has 8 coal-fired power plants. 8. And out of those 8 coal-fired power plants, all 8 of them. No, really, all 8, 1 through 8. No, you don't even get to use the Dungeons and Dragons 8-sided die. No. All 8 of Tennessee's coal-fired power plants that have coal ash dams, well, at least they got inspected by the EPA, but it wasn't exactly reassuring. Because all 8 of those power plants got dam ratings, from the job-killing Environmental Protection Agency, that their dams were either in significant danger or posed a high hazard. Ain't that reassuring? Coal, it keeps the lights on. In funeral homes. Then there's North Carolina Stan, which has a larger number of high-hazard coal ash impoundments than any other state in the southeastern United States. Hello, Eden, North Carolina. I guess they were right. Then there's South Carolina Stan, where they don't want nothing to do with no damn regulation from the job-killing EPA. And therefore, the state of South Carolina, Stan, has not even gathered enough data regarding its coal ash dams for the EPA to be able to rate the coal ash dams. There are 12 coal-fired coal ash facilities in South Carolina, Stan. And of those 12, only one has received a safety rating whatsoever. So, in other words, South Carolina is practicing a little bit of that nullification that led to that dust-up back in 1861. They're still practicing it. Sounds like they may have gotten it right, if you're an industry fan. If you care about the ability not to be poisoned, they have gotten it entirely wrong. And then Kentucky, that dark and bloody ground. No other state in the southeast has as many coal-fired power plants as Kentucky Stan does. Of all of those coal-fired power plants, nearly 50% of them have been rated to have either significant or high hazard problems as established by the job-killing EPA. And finally, Georgia Stan. There are 11 coal-fired power plants that have been evaluated by the EPA in Georgia. Only 7 of the 11 have had their dams rated by the job-killing EPA. Of those 7, 6 were noted to be high hazard structures. Yeah. Rochelle may have been right. Friday in the fetal position. It's either FOTFP or FITFP. Pick a vowel. And we have to add into this mix, of course, the ongoing poison disaster in West Virginia. Today I saw something on Facebook where presumptive senatorial candidate, West Virginia Secretary of State, and alleged Democrat Natalie Tennant is putting out her call for a transparent investigation of this disaster in Charleston. I support the idea of a transparent investigation, as long as by transparent we don't mean that it's the damn thin you can see through. Yeah? Yeah. She wants a full, transparent investigation as to how this could possibly have been allowed to happen. What's interesting, however, with regard to allegedly Democratic Secretary of State Natalie Tennant, who hopes to be a member of the Congress of the United States if she can only defeat West Virginia's most corrupt governor's daughter, Shelley Moore Capito, What's interesting about Natalie Tennant's position is that it was actually a few days before this current disaster became public. It was, in point of fact, January the 5th. The disaster would take place on January the 9th, or at least it would appear. That's when people officially acknowledged it after some 8 or 10 hours of dithering on the part of good old Governor Earl Ray, who should resign, or if he does not have the common decency to do that, should be promptly impeached and removed from office. It was on January 5th when I wrote the following. The folks at the Gazette were kind enough to publish it on the op-ed page. You can find it. I just searched Bob Kincaid, West Virginia Gazette, op-ed. It was titled, "The Sound of Silence." And I wrote, "Upon beginning a new year, people often make lists. I have made one myself. It is a list that would be too long if it contained only one name. The number of West Virginia's leading politicians who remain silent on the health crisis exploding, along with the 5.5 million pounds of ammonium nitrate and fuel oil explosives going off every business day in southern West Virginia's mountaintop removal zone, is a shameful reality. Shelley Moore Capito, Joe Manchin, Jay Rockefeller, Nick Joe Rahal, David McKinley, Earl Ray Tomlin. None of these politicians have ever dared publicly ask why people living in southern West Virginia suffer disproportionate levels of heart disease, why they die from shocking levels of cancer in their mountaintop removal communities, why unconscionable numbers of birth defects afflict them, why excess deaths stalk our towns and keep the lights on in our funeral homes. We know by her own silence regarding the scientific reports showing all the toxic horrors inflicted upon mountaintop removal communities that Representative Shelley Moore Capito, the presumptive Republican nominee for the seat being vacated at the end of the year by Senator Rockefeller, cares not the least about disease, suffering, and death in the southern West Virginia mountaintop removal zone. Her silence is ample evidence of her disdain. Will her likely Democratic opponent, Natalie Tennant, join in Ms. Moore Capito's silence? More hopefully, does Ms. Tennant have the strength and courage to lend her voice to those who have none? If elected, will Ms. Tennant commit to introducing a Senate version of H.R. 526, the Appalachian Communities Health Emergency Act? This critically important bill provides a way for people to find out why, and more importantly, how, they are being poisoned in communities near mountaintop removal sites. It would also have no impact on anyone currently working on MTR sites already permitted to operate. How could a person of conscience not support such a bill? In the Senate, Joe Manchin has run from the AIC Act as fast as his coal-beholden legs will carry him. We are still waiting for him to publicly acknowledge that the host of scientific studies regarding disease in the MTR zone even exists. Jay Rockefeller, to his credit, talks a lot about miners' health and safety. Still, he has also thus far refused to speak for people who are daily poisoned merely because the coal industry's profit centers moved in where they already live. As he nears the culmination of a long and storied political career, why Senator Rockefeller, with nothing left to fear from Big Coal, remains silent on an issue of such obvious urgency is baffling. It's also just plain sad. Ms. Moore Capito, along with Messrs. Rahal and McKinley, have steadfastly remained as silent as the tombs to which mountaintop removal area victims all too often proceed. History is written about the past, but it's written in the present. In their deafening silences, West Virginia's current crop of A-list politicians have written histories for themselves that will not be kind to their memories. Here, then, is the question for Ms. Tennant. Will she join Capito, Manchin, and the other members of the Coven of the Craven, or will she speak out for human rights, human health, and human dignity by endorsing and vowing to introduce the AIC Act. I am certain I am not the only voter who anxiously awaits Ms. Tennant's answer. Well, it don't much matter how anxious I or any other voter is, are, am, in West Virginia. The only thing to come out of Natalie Tennant's camp was a chorus of very, very, very quiet crickets. That was January the 5th. The AIC Act, H.R. 526, calls for a fully funded federal study of why and what the connection is between mountaintop removal and vastly increased disease rates in southern West Virginia. But suddenly, Natalie Tennant wants a thorough, transparent investigation of the disaster relating to Freedom Industries. This point, then. If Natalie Tennant cannot endorse the AIC Act, which has built into it such a transparent investigation, then why should anyone believe she's sincere in wanting an investigation of the Freedom Industries coal prep chemical disaster? I don't think there's a flaw in the question there. Does she only want a transparent investigation as long as it doesn't touch the beloved coal industry? Does she only want a because then it's not a transparent investigation. Does she only want a transparent investigation because it affected the well-to-do in the Kanawha Valley? I mean, it didn't only affect the well-to-do, it affected everybody. But this time, the well-to-do were included in the affect as well as the hoi polloi, or the hillbilly polloi, as opposed to those people up those hollers. We damned well deserve an answer. We will likely damned well not get one. But I think it's fair to ask the question. It's more than fair. It's more than fair because, you know, as of yesterday, another passel of school children were sent home from Overbrook School, Watts School, and Robbins School after they experienced more toxic, illness-inducing, poisonous fumes. Not odors. Odors, please. Bless their hearts, the Charleston Gazette had the common decency not to call them odors in the headline. MCHM sends more students home. But then in the subhead, Overbrook Watts Robbins close after odor returns. Odor? How about fumes? Now, if I need straightened up on chemical lexicography, let me know. But if it's an odor, well, you can not like an odor. I mean, you can if your precious darling baby loads up a Pampers, there's going to be an odor, and it may be unpleasant, but nobody's going to the hospital over it. On the other hand, there are fumes, there are vapors, and if you're getting sick from it, well, it's obviously toxic or poisonous. Second paragraph of Mackenzie May's story says, now some schools in Kanawha County, this is yesterday, are being forced to close again because the black licorice odor associated with the crude MCHM coal cleaning chemical. Yay for you, Mackenzie, for pointing out what it is. And there are reports of fainting and other side effects while faucets are running, posing questions about the potential dangers of inhaling the water's fumes as well. Three Kanawha County schools abruptly closed Thursday after school members, staff members, reported that they'd smelled the odor or breathed in the vapors or fumes. And cooks complained of burning eyes and nausea. Yeah. Kanawha County School Superintendent Ron During said the school system will now work with a response team made up of the National Guard and local health officials. Oh, my aching back. That will be called in if needed. Really? Really? We've got to throw if needed in there? I think the fact that we're turning kids loose from school after they've been brought into the school and the damn fumes are already and the vapors are already in the schools again, I think the if needed becomes superfluous in that sentence. Do you? Don't you? The level at which MCHM can be detected in water is apparently 10 parts per billion. That's the absolute minimum, according to this article. And yet, less than that is apparently enough to cause fumes and vapors to be released into interior spaces. Because reporter Mackenzie Mays notes that water samplings don't take into account how the chemical might affect people who are exposed to steam or water vapor that contains the chemical, such as when hot water faucets or dishwashers are turned on. Yeah, how do you flush a dishwasher? Just asking. Because I don't know. Kind of stumped. School Superintendent Ron During said, health experts have told us that odors may remain in the water, but that does not mean the school is unsafe. We understand that students, parents, and teachers remain concerned.
No, no, Ron, if you understand they're concerned, then you don't understand at all, buddy. They're not concerned. They're effing terrified. Because those are their children. Those are the future of the state.
You know, the whole, I believe the children of the future, and teach them well, and don't poison their little lungs with crude methylchlorohexane methanol.
Yeah, that.
Concerned.
This is a terrifying disaster.
But it is also an exercise in learning how hard public officials will work to keep from using actual, accurate language. Nobody's out there saying run for the hills, and I'm not suggesting anybody would. We're already in the hills.
West Virginia Department of Education spokeswoman Liza Cordero said that West Virginia DOE and county school systems have not discussed conducting air quality tests.
Ah, why would you want to? I mean, the cooks and folks are only getting sick by breathing this poisonous filth. Why would you want to conduct air quality tests? Well, good God, it's a chemical, crude methylchlorohexane methanol, whose MSDS sheet says carcinogenesis unknown, mutagenesis unknown. So, is there even a standard for how much of this is undeadly to breathe?
According to a press release, the schools plan to be open today, a decision that was made by health department officials, the governor's office, the National Guard, and the Department of Education. Once again, probably not in consultation with the actual stakeholders, otherwise known in this case as moms and dads. Honest to God, if I was a parent in Kanawha County,
you just have to come and arrest me. Because until such time as the people who take a fiduciary duty and stand in loco parentis for parents, in place of parents, during the school day, until such time as they can guarantee, thank you, Justin Wilson, until such time as they can do that, that my baby is not going to breathe that poison or ingest that poison or get touched by that poison. Nope. Baby ain't going to school. The only thing that the manufacturer of crude methyl chlorohexane methanol has, Eastman Chemical, has to say about its effects are that inhalation at elevated temperatures, whatever elevated means, vapor may cause irritation of eyes and respiratory tract. Well, it's just irritation. I mean, that's like a bug bite, right? Sometimes bug bites can give you things like encephalitis and malaria and God knows what. What the hell does irritation mean? Does it mean that it's going to burn every time you try to breathe? We don't know. We don't know. The Eastman MSDS says, in case of irritation from airborne exposure, move to fresh air. Get medical attention if symptoms persist. By the way, this occurred to me. So we've got cooks and school children and folks being sent to the hospital to be checked out after they've been subjected to some degree or another, some level or another of this toxic coal prepping chemical. Who's paying the hospital bills? I mean, under optimum circumstances, the child is insured, the school employee is insured. What if they're not? Because I know for a fact that there are people in the state of West Virginia and their children who are not covered by either Medicaid or for-profit insurance. Who pays that hospital bill? Does this mean you have to hook up with some law firm that's suing the bastards while the phone rings off the hook from some asshat collection agency because you went to the hospital because you were afraid your baby had been poisoned? It's just a question. Just a question. Meanwhile, as I noted a couple of minutes ago, Richard Dennison, who is the senior scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund, who was among the very first people to sound the alarm about this god-awful disaster, Richard Dennison pointed out that there, and this is a quote, there is no data directly on what levels are safe in the air. The notion that the CDC number of concentrations in water gives you any information about safe levels in the air is just, wait for it, false. Dennison went on to say that local officials should not, state and local officials should not try to downplay any symptoms reported by students or school employees given the lack of air quality monitoring and toxicity data. We're 28 days after the spill, and this stuff is still being detected in the homes and schools, at least by the nose. It suggests this whole business about flushing isn't working. So that's the current context. What else? Well, this
jolly little snippet. Headline, again, from the surely to God they'll have Pulitzers just being left by the case at their door, Charleston Gazette. David Gutman and again Mackenzie Mays. As school water issues continue, officials deny health link.
Oh, really? God damn, I'm surprised at that, aren't you?
I mean, after all, can I please I just want to back up a minute and remind people that way, way, way back when I believe the community health survey that indicated increased risks of cancer in mountaintop removal communities was published, peer-reviewed, no less. I remember somebody trying to ask good old Governor Earl Ray, who should, if there was any justice in the universe, have the word former placed in front of governor. Good old Governor Earl Ray responded to a question about the cancer risk by saying, well, every day somebody says something else makes you sick. It was he and his director of the Bureau of Public Health who declared that all them people showing up at the hospital after this disaster probably had the flu. Yeah, this brand new story. It's out today. Government and water company officials continue to say there is no clear link between the chemical detected at the schools and the reported maladies. Because some days, when you just happen to smell a toxic licorice-like odor that causes your respiratory tract to start to burn and your eyes begin to burn and it causes you to faint dead away, well, hell, there ain't nothing that says there's a connection between that and the fact that it was the damn chemical and that the chemical that was in the water is actually in your lungs and eyes. I mean, shoot. The detectable amount of MCHM at George Washington High School was found to be 18.33 parts per billion. They did not close the school. Fourteen schools reported the fumes yesterday. Only three closed as a result. Yeah. But remember, there's no clear link between the chemical detected at the schools and the reported maladies. Maybe they was going to faint anyway. They might have faintinitis. I mean, these other stuff makes your eyes burn. And shoot, you know, you can pepper up your eggs real good, and that'll make your respiratory tract burn. I mean, that's why you sneeze, ain't it? Right. Oh, by the way, you might find this interesting. Thank you to Isaac for tweeting this along. Headline from Climate Progress at thinkprogress.org. Emily Aiken reporting, despite not using water, West Virginians say water bills have spiked since chemical spill. Oh, of course. I mean, people exist in order to generate profits for the immortal corporate citizens, don't we? Emily Atkin writes, many West Virginians have not been using their water since a massive chemical spill tainted their water last month. Despite this, some say their water bills are outrageously high. The bills, according to West Virginia Citizen Action Group, fine bunch of people, are worth more than the credits that West Virginia American Water has offered to people who had to flush their water system several times since the MCHM disaster. not to mention the PHP, and probably some formaldehyde, and, well, you know, who's counting? Charleston resident Patrick S. Lawson Sr. got his water bill. The water bill showed that he used 600 gallons of water since January 30th. Mr. Lawson said that that's just factually incorrect. He said he's taken two showers, done two loads of laundry, and run his dishwasher twice. Oh, bless their pointy little heads. West Virginia American Water's going to try to figure out a way to make a buck off of this yet. Can't beat it with a stick now, can you? Nope. So it's a minute past the hour of 7 o'clock here in the Eastern Time Zone on this Friday on the front porch, or alternatively, depending on how this is affecting you, Friday in the fetal position. And I encourage you to join in, the conversation going on in the HeadOnRadioNetwork.com chat room, and, B, join in the Friday on the Front Porch conversation. We have four lines open, about to be three lines open. They'll fill up quickly. 304-658-3333. And, or, join in the Horn Molloy Skype chat group, if you haven't already, by sending a contact request on Skype to Sparky Dunk, SparkyDunc. And we, in turn, will get the conversation going after an ever-so-brief break. This is Conversation Radio. It is Conversation Radio that you determine will exist and that you fund to keep existing. And I want to thank Jack for helping out this evening. We are now only $260 away from finishing the week to the good. So thank you, Jack, very kindly for jumping in there with Kevin and with Sal. Thank you. And with Asa. Thank you. Recalculating, 240. 240. Thank you. One and all. So light them up. We got 2 hours of rollicking good conversation, I hope. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid. Do you notice that how for the Hollies, the air, sometimes all I need, the air that I breathe comes first before the to love you part? It wasn't lost on me. Everything passed, right. What we have here, in a way, is a great big jumping up and down, howling exposition of the actual workings of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. Not in the song, mind you, but in the disaster. No air? Well, counting up the rest of your needs, it's going to be superfluous at best. And even shelter, which Maslow references, shelter is going to be kind of meaningless if you can't breathe the air inside the shelter without fainting or something burning or eyes burning. Right. There is no direct correlation between these sissies getting sick and going to the hospital and the damned crude MCHM spill, which has nothing to do with the coal industry. What do we have to... Don't you people understand? It's Friday on the front porch on the horn. It is 8 minutes past 7 p.m. I'm Bob Kincaid. Immediately after the close of the program, I got a pack. I took out my commemorative Beatles 1964 suit, but the mop top wig was a little moth eaten, so I'm going to pass on that. But yeah, I'm off to New York City tomorrow, and looking forward to it. Getting lots of suggestions of things to do in New York City. Unfortunately, there's not going to be a lot of time to do them in. I get there at 7. And then, of course, in the morning, it's off to the NBC studios. I'm just really kind of making my Zen focus not saying booger or fainting or anything. Yeah. Because there's a lot that needs to be said. There's so much that needs to be said. I mean, so much information has come along that it becomes so easy to pass by some rather obvious failings in this. And I'm not just talking about letting a bunch of good old boys who used to run bars keep toxic chemicals a mile and a half away from the public water supply. I'm not talking about that. I'm talking about the fact that good old Governor Earl Ray declined, you know, because we didn't want none of them job-killing regulations, declined to put into place the U.S. Chemical Board recommendation that would have kept this from happening. Great God Almighty. Wow. Turns out that we have our own version of Bin Laden determined to strike inside U.S. Only Governor Earl Ray didn't go brush cutting down in Texas. Governor Earl Ray called up his buddies in the coal industry and said, y'all boys all right, I'm worried about you. I'm worrying about you all the time. I think that's all I do is I think about y'all. Because I love you. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, he did that. He really, really did. That's not me making stuff up. That's no hyperbole. He rejected, his administration rejected a plan that would have prevented this in the first place. Kind of like Duke Energy kept the EPA from adopting a silly little rule that would have prevented some 80-some-odd thousand tons of toxic coal ash waste from
flowing into the Dan River. I said Dan River. So
we've got two lines open. If you want to get in on the telephone side of Friday on the Front Porch, let's find out who our first contestants are. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, you talking to me?
I guess I am. Is that you, Dan?
It is Dan.
Awesome, awesome. Let's see who's on line two.
Hey, fool, hey. Like an old fool, buddy.
Hey, Bill, what's happening?
Well, if I knew that, I'd be there.
Well, if you were here, you'd probably know more than I do, but that's next to nothing anyway, so.
Well, I'm delighted. I just got a book finally shipped from the volunteers to read it at the site center. It's The Gardeners of Salonika, which is a history of a campaign during World War I that was kind of forgotten, but interesting.
Cool.
Yep.
It sounds very interesting. Note coming in from Robert in Australia. Subject line, outrageous bills. Robert asks, outrageous bills? We had a case here in Australia of a young couple who went away for 3 months. So they turned off and unplugged everything in their home and pulled all the fuses. So no electricity was being used in the home at all. A week after they returned, 3 months later, they received an electricity bill for the period of their absence. It was $50 more than the bill for their previous quarter. When they asked their electricity company to explain, they were told their bill was a guesstimate based on previous usage. When asked why their meter hadn't been read, it was explained that doing so costs money and that no one else had complained. Needless to say, the guesstimating of bills is now frowned upon. I don't even know. And it's not just that one guy in Charleston. I mean, I'm seeing this on Facebook. I'm seeing it. Yeah, there's plenty of people noting that. And by the way, West Virginia American Water said, you all can forget about getting any more credits to your dadgum bills. Stop your belly aching and drink the water. We've got shareholders to service. Let's bring on another line, which means we will have one more phone line open for those as wish to participate in this here Friday on the Front Porch or Friday in the fetal position, depending on how you feel about things. Hey, welcome to the program.
I personally like Friday in the fetal position.
It has rather a ring to it, doesn't it, Kevin?
Right. And especially during this ongoing now two disasters, West Virginia and North Carolina, which don't just cover West Virginia and North Carolina. I did notice an article earlier today saying that North Carolina stations downriver of the spill are saying they don't see any toxic effects from all this coal ash being spilled. And I'm like, yeah, right. So it was just rather interesting how they don't want to nip.
Yeah, well, that's the same mindset that brings you, just because people are going to the hospital sick with this chemical exposure doesn't mean the chemical exposure caused them to go to the hospital.
So, yeah.
Aristotle has worn the sides of his grave smooth with the spinning.
Oh, yeah. And the other thing that occurred to me when you first started talking about this today, Bob, was that, you know, the Nestle chairman may well get his wish one day. If we keep on going on like this, we may well have to be paying for our water. That is, if we want drinkable, non-chemically laden water. So,
Bob, I'm having trouble hearing Kevin.
Okay. Well, Kevin, just try to make sure you're speaking directly into the telephone's microphone, okay?
Yeah, I've noticed that, too. I think I'm probably on the line that does this. I've noticed that.
Well, no, you're sharing the same telephone hybrid with Bill.
Oh, okay.
My God, I'm sure I'm loud enough.
Yeah, no, you both sound great. Hey, Dan, are you able to hear those two?
I'm able to hear both of these guys. And a week or so ago, Jim was extremely faint.
Yeah, see, everybody, since I've got two lines on one channel here, you can have two different levels of, because everybody has a different phone now. So one can be loud, one can be faint, and it's a matter of me sitting here trying to engineer along the way. It's makes it, but you can hear them both though, right, Dan?
I can hear them both.
Okay. Bill, Kevin, can you hear
you're
Dan?
Clean. You're clean, that's for sure. I can hear you and I can hear Dan.
Okay.
Yeah, I can hear Bill. He's a little bit faint, but I can hear him.
Okay, great. All right. So far, so good. Let's bring on the Skype Malloy Horn chat group. Evening, folks.
Hi, Bob. We can hear everybody on the phone lines just fine.
Beautiful. And that, of course, is Sparky.
Waggy will be back in 60 seconds.
Okay, so Waggy's with us. Hey, Larry.
Howdy.
By golly, we've got you saying howdy like a real live hillbilly, Larry.
Yep.
And Greg is with us.
Hey, Bob.
What's happening, Greg?
Not a whole lot.
Okay. And Grant is with us from out Oregon way.
Greetings from Portland.
And greetings from the hills and hollers. And Jay Cruzen's with us.
Yo.
Hey, how about that? We've got Duncan and Yo-Yo. Ha! Huh. Product placement.
Ah, your sense of humor goes up and down.
I used to get harassed all the time as a kid.
I hope we didn't bring up any unfond memories.
No, I used to love my yo-yos.
Duncan's really were the best.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
Remember the butterfly, the Duncan butterfly?
Yeah, I had the butterfly. I loved the Imperial though.
I had the Imperial. Yeah, the Imperial. You could do more with the Imperial, it seemed like.
Well, Bob, you know, I'm right in the middle of watching the Aaron Brockovich movie. You know that movie with Albert Finney and Julia Roberts?
Oh, yes.
Yeah, that one. I'm in the middle of it.
Here comes Sergi.
And waiting.
He just messaged me.
Oh, I see him.
Yeah, it may take a minute. Anyway, so when I heard you were going to New York, it made me think about when I was there in 2006.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, but of course I had a couple of days to look around.
Well, I've had, and unfortunately I don't because, you know, you can get in a car and be in New York City from where I am in something like 10 hours.
Mm-hmm.
But we're expecting snow, so that's probably not advisable. And me driving in New York is probably equally unadvisable. I don't think I would understand the hand signals that are apparently involved.
Well, anyone driving in New York is unadvisable.
Watch out for that middle finger salute there.
Well, that's the thing. Apparently, there are different permutations of that depending on which way it's angled and right. But no, you can drive there in 10 hours. But to fly there, I got to go to Atlanta and from Atlanta to New York. And that's not me complaining about the Atlanta airport. I happen to love Hartsfield International Airport. But it cuts into, I'd like to have gotten there in daylight, I guess is what I'm saying. But it's supposed to be snowing here and snowing there, last I checked. But I'm getting tons of suggestions. Hey, Bob, you got to go eat here. Hey, Bob, you got to go eat there. I've been told that it is an absolute must that I eat at least one slice of standard New York utility pizza.
Well, hey, Bob, have fun sitting in the airport while it snows.
Oh, no.
Hey, Bob, you've heard of Nathan's, haven't you?
Oh, yeah.
Well, you got to go there.
I don't know that it's going to be time.
Oh, because I think from what I've heard you talk about, you are a chili dog eater.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yes, yes, yes. A buddy of mine told me, about a place that makes God's own hamburger down in the village, and somebody else suggested that, you know, Bob, you're always talking about, you're such a foodie, you gotta go to Mario Batali's joint. I'm pretty sure you can't get within a mile of the place on a Saturday night without reservations.
Bob, is this going to be a new interview with Melissa Harris-Perry, or I guess it is?
Yeah, I mean,
having you back.
Yeah, it blew my mind. They're bringing me up there for purposes of having this conversation, and I'm thrilled to death.
Bob, is this a Sunday morning broadcast or Saturday?
No, it's Sunday.
Sunday morning.
Yeah, I fly up tomorrow, fly home Sunday afternoon.
Okay.
No, yeah, it starts...
When I'm just having a TV.
It starts at, I think, 10 o'clock Eastern time, and then the segment that I'm on is at 11:30 Eastern time.
I think it's actually only 90 minutes this Sunday because of the Olympics.
Oh, okay. Oh, God, I hope I don't get bumped on the on account of the Olympics. But is the Olympics running on MSNBC, too?
Yes. No.
Really? I haven't seen it.
Sunday it is. All Saturday night, Sunday morning.
Oh.
You're right after the women's hockey game.
Don't they use, like, about four
yes.
stations? They use Bravo, too? And
yes, they do.
And Super CNBC?
NBC Olympics mm-hmm. TV schedule. There's a nice website.
And I guess there were failings at the opening ceremony. At least I heard about them this afternoon while I was in the car. One of Vladimir Putin's Olympic rings didn't light up.
A snowflake didn't make the transformation to an Olympic ring.
Right. That's how it was described. Snowflake. One lonely little snowflake.
Well, physically in the Soviet, I'm showing my age.
Maybe it was gay.
In Russia, where are they located?
It's in Sochi.
It's on the Black Sea.
It's on the Black Sea. It's in Crimea, no. I'm just guessing, you know. I'm showing my age when I talk about that stuff, you know, like Second World War crap, you know.
Yeah, I'm looking at it now.
Good evening, everyone.
Good evening, Sergi.
Hey, Sergi.
Yeah, it's on the eastern shore of the Black Sea, just barely north of the Georgian border, on the Black Sea coast. Bill,
the land of peace and happiness, Georgia.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. In point of fact, that's remember when the Boston Marathon bombing took place?
Yeah.
And Dr. John called in explaining the importance of the Caucasus and how it became a crossroads of human transmigration. Yeah, there.
Anybody who's good with a computer, go look up the World War One fighting between Turkey and Russia and see, count those folks, boy.
Yeah.
Savage in the mountains.
And this is, unfortunately, how do I make this go away? I've got a big black box over it, but it's south of Krasnodar and south of Rostov and southwest of Kalmykia. So it's
you lost me there, but
it's north. It is northwest of Georgia and Dagestan.
Stephanie Miller was pointing out on her show that it's pretty ironic that, you know, for the Winter Olympics, the Russians apparently, you know, wanted to showcase the only city in the country, the only major city in their country where palm trees grow.
Human nature, my God, perfect.
And what kind of given the history of their problems, especially in the last few decades, it rather surprises me that Sochi is due west of Chechnya, kind of begging, you know.
Oh yeah,
begging for trouble.
Well, did you guys hear about that guy that tried to hijack the airliner?
I saw something about it. Where was it bound for, Sparky?
I don't remember, but they landed in Turkey is all I know.
But he wanted to go to Sochi.
Yeah. So maybe he was thinking about forcing it to dive bomb the games or something.
Well, I did notice that the pictures of glasses of water in Sochi looked like they had been imported from
West Virginia American Water.
Good one.
Thank you. Thank you very kindly. Well, given everything that I was ruckus raising about in the first hour, let me just check. This is just a little check in, because y'all are all outside the sacrifice zone here. Would any of you, and this applies both to the telephone and to the Skype group, would any of you drink so much as a glass of water from West Virginia American Water System in the Kanawha Valley?
Hell no.
Yes, sir, Bob.
Not a chance in hell.
No, thank you.
No way.
I would break into my earthquake supply.
Oh, hell, I don't know why not. Game all of it is in the air anyway. You're breathing it. Why not drink it?
Good point there.
Well, I think most of us are breathing something or another. I mean, you know, Dallas-Fort Worth, you know, we're not known for poisoned water. We're known for toxic air. I mean, for something like a decade in a row, every summer we failed federal air standards.
Well, yeah, around that, around a few refineries.
Los Angeles of the Midwest.
No, there ain't no refineries up here, Jason. It's the refineries is Houston's problem. They're the reason Houston's air is so toxic. The reason our air is so toxic is because the entire greater Dallas-Fort Worth metroplex is built on rampant, unsustainable suburban sprawl. And so most everyone drives everywhere. And, I mean, you know, there's people, I mean, they'll you know, people around here are so lazy they'll drive to go two blocks to the corner store, you know. And so, you know, that's what causes our air to be so toxic. It's just automobile pollution.
Well, it's windy, right?
Like South, that's so, just like South Florida, but, yeah, we have the wind to carry all that crap out.
Right.
There.
Fuck it. Somebody else's
problem. And then
it
it deposits right in the damn ocean. Or the Everglades, depending on which way the wind's going.
Well, you know, Tim from L.A. just pointed out in the chat room, he said, no way I'm drinking that stuff, Bob. I don't even drink Los Angeles' tap water.
We actually do have wind here. I mean, North Texas is a very windy region. However, during the summertime, the dominant wind is usually from the south. So guess what city south of us? Houston. Their pollution just gets blown up here. Our pollution blows to the north to Oklahoma City, and Houston's pollution blows up to Dallas-Fort Worth.
Well, then you do get a little bit of a taste of the refineries.
Yeah, I suppose you're correct.
Here's a little something fascinating. I just got a tweet from Sandra with color photographs of Sochi in the early 1960s Soviet era. And it looks lovely. What Sochi was apparently after the Russian people had rid themselves of the notion of royalty inside the Soviet communist scheme of things, they came up with this notion that working people should probably get to relax once in a while. And Sochi was the playground of the working people. And a lot of the mansions that had been confiscated from the blood-sucking royalty were turned into spas for working people who were guaranteed a vacation, and where you went on your vacation was Sochi. And it had rocky beaches and lots of sun and people walking around in bathing suits and... The writer of this article notes, we visited the Union, as part of our tour of the Soviet Union, we visited the Union-run spas and learned that miners, whose conditions of work were so hazardous, received extra vacation days annually with special therapy and medical attention to keep them healthy.
One way they were ahead of us, that's for sure.
The writer says, my father, Harvey Richards, had recently completed a film, Perch of the Devil, 1960, about miners in Butte, Montana, where the hazards of mining work were repaid with an early grave and miserable poverty. The contrast has never left me. Sochi became a place forever associated in my mind with a society that marshaled its resources for the benefit of the people.
Yeah, dang communists.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, they're going to ruin it. Yeah, they're just going to ruin everything for everybody, aren't they? I mean, all those working people going on vacation, you can't have that. So, just turning back, because, see, I turn these questions over in my mind again and again and again. I really do, regarding this ongoing disaster. How do you, and everybody jump in on this, how do you solve this problem? Scientifically, philosophically, aesthetically, pick one. How do you solve this problem?
Which one?
Well, I mean, pick one. First of all, how do you make sure? Who's responsible for making sure that people have not just not just enough water, but plenty of water? Because enough water is kind of a miserly standard. I mean, I've said before that people are being asked to live in ways that their forebears did and are ill suited to do it. Do we need, for instance, one of those bag showers that you take camping? Does everybody need to have one of those distributed to them? Should people be forced to purchase those on their own? When their water was poisoned through no fault of their own? I mean, it's not like the water got cut off because they didn't pay their bill.
Yeah, but Bob, that other stuff's socialism, isn't it? I mean, God, giving you a water bag to shower in, that's socialism, buddy. I'm sorry.
We used a 5-gallon bucket with a hose coming out of the bottom with a shower nozzle on it, head on it. It had a little, you know, open-close switch. Right on the handle of, and at our cabin we.
But I mean, should there be a governmental initiative, Sparky, to hold seminars so people can learn how to make those?
Go to YouTube.
The way that us homie types tend to shower when we are unable to take a full, you know, proper bathroom shower is, it only requires perhaps a gallon of water, for this method, and, you know, your bar soap or whatever you're using. The slang term for it is called an airplane bath. And the reason for that, you'll have to excuse my French here, you clean the wings. You can see where I'm going with this. You clean the wings, you clean the tail, and you clean the cockpit.
How did I know? I kind of saw that coming. Yeah, that was not the term that my father used or was taught back during World War II. I actually kind of prefer airplane shower as opposed to what my dad was taught to say, which I will not use.
Oh, you got me curious now, Bob. You can't drop that bomb and run.
Well, no, he just called it a whore's bath.
Wow, yeah, I've heard plenty of slang, because, you know, there's also bird bath and, you know, airplane bath. I've never heard that term before. That one must be a bit dated.
No, it came out of the Navy.
My father called it the Marine douche.
My first wife referred to it as a school assistant, PTA.
Next.
And a woman. She and I had matching sense of humor. That's why we lasted 10 years. Shit, people.
Well, I've got a great solution to your fresh water problem, Bob.
Okay.
Excuse me. Well, I mean, you know, have you not noticed all the, I'm sure you've seen the documentaries that show the rivers of water that are just flowing right out of Greenland because of global warming.
Yeah.
Collect it. Build a pipeline.
But there's... Yeah, build a pipeline. That's good.
Well, if you stop and contemplate, like in this major cities in the east, how old the water system is, how old the electrical system is. One house I lived in still had gas outlets in it for gas lights.
There are districts in Fort Worth like that when it comes to the water. excuse me. Fort Worth's water is actually pretty clean. Doesn't have a huge amount of contaminants in it. Tastes pretty decent and no longer has a smell. Now, I remember during the last decade, the double nipples or double zeros or whatever you want to call it, there was a slight sewage-ish smell to Fort Worth water, but the city insisted it was clean, and we drank it anyway, because what other choice did we have? And they turned out to be right. It somehow had that funky smell to it, but it was actually perfectly fine. The local media did investigations and found, it's fine, but it just, now they've gotten rid of the smell. I mean, it's decent enough, but there are some districts where the piping that gets the water to houses, businesses, and such, it's old and gives the water a metallic smell and taste. Of no fault of the city water supply itself, it's just the pipes that need to be replaced.
So many things were done so long ago, and they either have to be redone or the whole damn place is going to collapse. And they don't want to spend the tax money to redo it. There were battles in Cleveland in the early 1900s when private streetcar companies would go out and tear up somebody else's lines and put in their own. Nice bunch.
By the way, Bill, you got a big laugh from Isaac on PTA.
Who?
From Isaac.
Oh, good. I'm glad I got it. I haven't talked to him in a while. I have to call the man and bug him one of these days soon. There's a guy I owe a lot to, I'll tell you.
Well, then just trying to pursue this a little bit further. I have said that out of an abundance of common decency, good old Governor Earl Ray probably should resign or at least then face impeachment. Does that do it, and I mean this is a serious question. Does that do any good or does it do harm in the midst of this problem?
Well, the last resort is to, and the last thing on your list is to throw out all the bums and get a new crowd in there.
I guess what I'm asking is he beginning to pose a public danger given the bizarre corporate first pronouncements and conduct out of his administration?
Well, he's no worse than Manchin or any of those other guys, is he?
Yeah, but he's governor.
And then you have to ask how many other officials pose a public danger from the president on down.
I'd say every one of them.
Lack of regulation. Yeah.
Come on down here and live in Rick Scott's state.
Yeah,
I'd say. But Charlie Crist is going to beat his ass, isn't he, Jay Cruzen?
I would think he will. Yes. I don't see any way that he won't win that. Unless they flood it with so much money. And you know, of course, well, Rick Scott spent $73 million of his own money the first time around, so I don't know how much he's got left from those billions and billions he defrauded Medicare of, but we'll have to wait and see.
$73 million of his own money?
Yeah, that's correct.
Good night. He wanted to... Good night. He must have really wanted to be governor.
$1 million for each time he pled the fifth.
Well, if Earl Ray were to be either impeached or if he had the common decency to resign, West Virginia does not have a lieutenant governor, and so
it would It would turn it from a political issue into a political campaign.
Well, what would happen is, because we don't have a lieutenant governor, the current president of the West Virginia Senate would become governor. And the president of the Senate of West Virginia is a senator by the name of Jeff Kessler, who is at least from Marshall County in the far northern panhandle, and not as miserable a lackey for the coal industry.
Yeah, but when is the next governor's election, or would there be a special?
Oh, the next election is years off.
Because I still think it would start the campaign for governor right away and turn it into just a campaign with all of its circus moves.
Well, we sorted out some of this acting business because Earl Ray Tomlin became governor because he was the president of the West Virginia Senate when Joe Manchin's ego got the better of him, and he decided he was sick of being governor and was going to run for the unexpired term of the then recently departed Robert C. Byrd in the Senate of the United States.
Well, so then doesn't Tomlin's term expire when his would have?
No. He got elected to his own term in 2012. He's got till 2016, and then he's done. He's term limited out. But my larger point is, you know, when his administration is running around saying things like people who were poisoned by this stuff were actually showing up at the hospital because of the flu, when the man rejects the very plan that would have prevented this, is it not just do you just take a pass on that? Because my mind says you don't. I mean, my mind says that if the people are the guardians of their own government, then when someone has screwed up that badly, they gotta leave.
Seems to me it's like criminal negligence, really. I mean, impeachable, certainly, I would think. If somebody really wanted to go after his scalp, seems like they could.
The shame of it is this country's growing on the backs of criminal negligence. I mean, there are things that probably the professor could point out that have been done over the years that, Truman sat on that committee in World War II investigating the money being spent in the services, and Truman, of all people, had some good things to say about some of the Republicans that were slapping some of the profiteers in jail. Now, I don't know how the hell that happened. Were things a little different in those days? I can't see a lot of these Republicans doing a damn thing about any kind of corruption they find.
Good Lord.
Remember, Bill, Governor Earl Ray is a Democrat.
Yeah, that's what they call themselves, yeah.
Yeah, he's a colocrat.
Yeah, colocrat, yeah. Because the Democrats were the working man's party when I was a youth.
Yeah.
That ought to get a few good laughs today.
Well, you know, I think the immediate concern would be to get FEMA in there to take care of the media problems. And then on the back burner would be to throw all the bums out.
Well, FEMA calls on me. How do you get it to work? Does the president have the power to put it to work, or does he have to get the congressional approval? And you start throwing stuff out, you know.
Yeah, well, get this. Now, I can't verify this personally, but there's an individual that's a friend of mine on Facebook whom I have known for, 26 years. And she raised such a ruckus with the governor's office, demanding that water resources continue to be provided to the people in the affected counties, that the governor's office responded to her that, well, that means we'd have to pay for it. Because FEMA has said that because the Water Corporation said the water's safe to drink, that they can't do nothing. Now, let that rattle around a minute. A corporation that is most interested in its own profits made a declaration that their toxic water is safe to drink, and therefore that hamstrings efforts at relief.
Wow. The amount of greed,
you know, there's got to be a way around
that. It's messed up, Bob.
Then you got to look to the, man. CDC, I guess, would have to say, no, it's not.
EPA.
Or EPA, either one.
EPA is the one that sets water standards. And test methods and all the things that are associated with it. Which means it'd have to go through Congress.
I did hear some good news about the EPA. They're going to start putting regulations on these holding pits or whatever you call them, lakes that you guys have up there, Bob.
That's coal ash dams.
Starting next year, I think.
Meanwhile, no one has done a damn thing, Jay Cruzan. No one's done a damn thing about the fact that the West Virginia Department of Environmental Protection allows coal companies to blast by these giant earthen dams that hold back toxic coal waste.
Maybe that'll be part of it, you know. I mean, they're going to do a whole evaluation on these coal ash dams, and so hopefully.
Well, regulation of coal ash as a toxic substance, or as hazardous waste, as I noted at the beginning of the program, was stopped dead in its tracks by the American Coal Ash Association and Duke Energy and a bunch of other coal-fired electricity providers early in the first term of Barack Obama, and stopped it cold, and that is why, in part, this disaster has happened up in Eden, North Carolina. Jay Cruzan, do you know that neck of the woods?
No, unfortunately, I don't. Give me a town close to Eden.
Well, the water out of the Dan River, where the pipe burst and sent the 80-some-odd thousand tons of poison into the river, flows downstream northward to Danville, Virginia.
Oh, okay. You're in the far northeast part of the state, then. Right?
That's what I thought. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I'm not familiar with that area very much.
It's in the far northeast part of the state. I probably went over it several times, going from Norfolk to, I can't think of the Marine base down there in North Carolina. But we used to transport the Marines back and forth from there, and our ship would port in there, and I'd be the ship's pre-arrival crew for Norfolk. So it makes me wonder if that's the case, if that's where it is. And that's not a good area for it to be a spill at because of the, you know, there's swamps in that too, aside from lakes and rivers.
Well, being another reason why I kind of guard my name here, but Duke Energy, oh, what a great company.
Really?
Yeah.
Bunch of real winners?
Well,
they're the ones who sent their lobbyist in to kill the designation of coal ash as toxic waste, Jay Cruz.
Yeah.
Did you work for them at one time?
As a contractor. And if there's any hope for me working for a utility in North Carolina, again, that will be the one. So, like I say,
we'll leave it lay then.
Lots of no comment then.
Well, what's interesting is that this power plant that dumped all this poison had been abandoned. It was inactive. It was apparently not generating electricity anymore. It was not burning any more coal. And so the coal ash dam was sitting there, and I guess what? Out of sight, out of mind?
Well, you just see the question has been hitting the old man's mind.
how many homes are still burning coal in this country?
You know, even here, Bill, I'm shocked because when the temperature goes down far enough and it starts getting cold, there's at least three houses here that are burning coal for heat. Because, well, y'all have probably heard me complain about the fumes or vapors or odor being smellable here in the studio.
Well, that
kind of drafty back.
You know, when I was a youngster, five or six, and I heard adults talking about coal, they were cussing out the price of it then. And that would have been 48, 49 in there. And everything was a coal furnace. My grandfather going down and shoveling the crap. My uncle was still getting it delivered in the 60s. I'd be out there working on a car, and here comes a guy in a rattle-trap truck. So old, you know, practically pulled by horses, and he'd be unloading, he'd be offloading a load of coal into my down the chute into my uncle's house. In fact, out here, one year about maybe 20 years ago, some guy hit the wrong entrance, what he thought was the coal chute, emptied a load of coal into the guy's basement, where it was just sitting there on the basement floor. It wasn't in the impoundment, you know. That was a sweet thing. Because, man, that was the heat when I was a boy.
Oh, yeah.
That was it.
Oh, there's a certain era where everybody knew about clinkers and, you know, not to put the metal ash bucket on a wooden floor, lest the wooden floor catch fire.
Well, I like to stand over the heat grate at age five and feel the warmth coming up from the basement, probably breathing this shit. No wonder I had trouble all my life.
It's not good for you.
You know, when you're that age, you're easily amused.
Hey, Dan, you've been way quiet.
Yeah, I know I have. I've just been absorbing this. You know, you mentioned folks earlier at schools and in other places smelling this stuff.
Yes.
And, you know, it's a fact that when you're able to smell something, you're taking in a scent particle, which is a tiny little bit of the substance itself. So when you think about being able to discern a scent, it's a form of ingestion. So when these people, these students or the workers in kitchens at schools and elsewhere are able to discern this licorice smell, they're actually exposing themselves to the poison itself. And I don't think that should be lost on anyone. And it also indicates its presence. So when you speak to this woman, if you mention that you know, these people are indicating to the authorities that they are discerning the odor, they're exposing themselves, and it's virtual proof that it is there in the. In the institutions, the schools, wherever else, the homes, for crying out loud. That should not be lost. There's a reason why dogs' noses are shaped the way they are. Because when a dog exhales, the little slats on the side of the dog's nose allow it to exhale so that the air goes sideways so it doesn't blow the scent particle off the ground, which it takes in to stay on a scent. And so... we know that it's a low-level form of ingestion. And there's no denying that if someone is smelling that licorice, that it is virtual evidence. I won't say proof, but evidence that that damn stuff is there. And the point you made a couple of days ago, Bob, about the septic systems. What are we going to do? And I say we because we are all in this together. You know, if it isn't Love Canal, goddammit, in Niagara Falls, and it's this or some other stinking Superfund site that is not being funded by corporations anymore, thanks to, I think, George W. Bush. All of these matters occur, a wound to one is a wound to all of us. And so I think that it's important to realize that when people are complaining and then being billed for this. God damn it. They're being billed for water they're not using. It's almost as if an insurance company that fails to get all the money that it needs to invest in and create its necessary level of return, then just jacks up rates. Well, it's almost like that. You know, these people are actually getting bills for water not being used is so disgusting. And it indicates a level of corporate control in our country that, which is, I think, Bob, you said it months ago, maybe a year or so ago, that once you begin to understand what's going on, you see it everywhere. And it was you or Malloy or maybe Rick Smith, but one of you guys said that, and I.
Well, if I didn't, I agree.
Man, oh man, I think it was you, but no matter what. Once you're tuned into what's really happening in our nation, for crying out loud, you guys being ignored not only by the media, other national politicians, but your own fucking representatives.
Yeah, but let me and this is not just me engaging in shameless brown nosing.
Yeah.
But I do want to point out, Dan, that one place we are not being ignored is MSNBC.
I hope not.
Sparky and I were chatting back and forth last night about Rachel's end of the program commentary about all of this, and she seemed right indignant. Chris Hayes has covered this. Obviously, Melissa Harris-Perry is keeping this on the radar. Joe Manchin went on Alex Wagner's program, and he got himself right indignant when she asked him some question that he didn't like. And even when Joe Manchin was on Rachel's program, at the end, she sort of damned him with faint praise when he said, "Well, we want West Virginia to have the best water in the country because West Virginia is the best place in the world." And Rachel responded by saying, "Well, thank you, Senator Manchin, for doing what you do so well."
Throw the ball.
Yeah. Yeah, go ahead.
I got a question. This chemical that was released into the river, what would happen, just say you take a jar of it or whatever, and dip a PVC pipe in it?
I don't know that that's... I don't know. I don't think anybody does.
Send it off to a lab.
Because from my understanding, that's a pretty caustic chemical, right? They use it to wash coal, for Christ's sakes. And
well, first off, you got to get your hands on it.
It's probably going to start melting the damn PVC pipe, which means that every bit of this stuff that's flown through people's houses has bonded and started eating into their pipes. And once it does that, it's there. It's just there. Period. It's there. I don't know if there's any way that you could ever get rid of it.
Which is precisely the nature of the conversation that we were having this time last week, which actually Rachel tapped into in her comments last night. And that is, if you think about this long enough, you can't help begin to wonder, what if the whole infrastructure is toast? Okay, here are some things we know, Jay Cruz. We know, for instance, that West Virginia American Water, statewide, cannot account for something on the order of 35% of the fresh water that it pumped in 2012, I think the number was. Okay? So if that number is anything similar for 2013 and the first 9 days of 2014, then that means there's a whole bunch of water banging around in the ground that's got this stuff in it, that they got no darned idea whatsoever where it went. Now, as you've noted in the past, based on your experiences here during power outages, we really are. West Virginians and hillbillies generally are a pretty self-reliant people. We are not afraid to get down there in the basement or dig a hole or what the hell ever it takes to replace a busted water line. We do it. I mean, it gets cold enough and it freezes up that PVC chicken bones, if you know what I mean.
We are not, you know, hell, we just as soon fix the pipe ourselves as call a plumber. A lot of people can't afford to call a plumber. Okay, we'll replumb our houses at some considerable cost, which means replacing not just the pipes, but the water fixtures themselves. Not just the pipes and the water fixtures, but the pipes, the water fixtures, and the water heater.
It's a considerable amount of work.
And when they were first telling people to flush their lines, you got to bear in mind, they were told to flush your lines. 2 days later, after the flushing had already started, well, lo and behold, guess what? They came out and said, wait a minute, hang on just a second. If you've got a septic system, which a whole bunch of people in this state do, don't flush your lines down into your septic system because it'll ruin your septic system. Instead, dump the poison water on the surface of the ground. Not kidding.
Okay, well, that right there tells you that that chemical is caustic enough that it's going to eat up your pipes.
And it's going to eat up your plastic septic tank.
That's for sure.
And which means it's going to continue to come out of your pipes every time you run the water.
And what if your septic tank is concrete instead of plastic?
That's what we use out here, concrete.
Yeah.
Yeah, we, you know, most places I've been are concrete. But what I'm saying is you're going to be drinking it forever until you replace your pipes. Because it's bonded to the PVC and then the little particles are going to let go.
Yeah. Well, now, okay, well now back up for a second. Okay, so... We know that there's an ungodly amount of this stuff that's running around free range, in the ground, wherever, because they can't account for, an unholy amount of the water that they pump out. One. Industrious self-reliant hillbillies go and replace their pipes. Two. Then it keeps stinking because this stuff is still finding its way into systems. So why should anybody go to the effort and the expense of replumbing their home when the water company cannot at this moment guarantee that they're not going to send more into it? That's what I'm getting at. We are looking at a massive, massive problem that no one has even dared mention or contemplate. And that is that West Virginia American Water Company is going to have to dig up and fix their entire antiquated, busted-ass, half-assed, tape and duct tape and spit and toilet paper and baling wire water system, which leads me to my next question. Why should these people be allowed to continue to provide water to the public? Why should they not be thrown out of this state on their ear and the people of the state of West Virginia take charge of their own water?
Well, yeah, the company and all its assets need to be seized in order to pay for, you know, at least part of the complete replacement of the system.
And yet, Waggy, you know as sure as God made little green apples that there are suits against West Virginia American Water Company, and my personal opinion is that the suits are well grounded. I mean, for God's sakes, how is not knowing there are thousands, tens of thousands of gallons of poison a mile and a half upstream from your intake, how is not knowing that not negligence? How is that the failure to do or not do the thing, a thing which a reasonable and prudent person in the same or similar circumstances would do or not do? How is that?
Oh, yeah, and it's willful negligence, too, because they knew about it for some time before they even told anyone, much less did anything about it.
I think it's gross. It's wanton. It's reckless.
Yeah. There's negligence in not knowing right away, and then when they did find out, there's willful negligence after that. So, yeah.
Guess what's going to happen out of any lawsuit from which a judgment arises against West Virginia American Water in some multi-million dollar amount? Guess what's going to happen? You already know. They're going to declare bankruptcy.
Right, and get liquidated.
They may not be liquidated. They may be allowed to continue to just reorganize and keep going.
Oh, yeah. There is that.
What's the actual name of that substance again, Bob?
But their charter needs to be yanked.
It is crude methyl chlorohexane methanol.
That's eating plastic pipes. I'll promise you that. I've done a lot of work with plastics, and I recognize a lot of that nastiness in that name, and it's eating the PVC pipes, and it will be there in those PVC pipes forever.
Until I know a bit of organic chemistry, and I concur.
And so let's take it a step further. We know that West Virginia American Water's infrastructure, before it ever reaches anybody's house, is the waterworks equivalent of an amalgamation of spit and toilet paper and duct tape and baling wire, figuratively speaking. How big is a water main?
Varies, Bob.
Well,
give me the range.
The mains
give me the range.
A foot in diameter, give or take. They're
okay.
Actually fairly small. They're under high pressure.
Okay, so some of those are going to be some sort of plastic, are they not?
Most of them should be steel. Or what?
The new ones are plastic. The older ones are going to be steel, asbestos, concrete, a whole mix of stuff that's been popular over the years.
And so once this stuff has flowed through it for, and let's remember, I think we have to really, really get our heads around the genesis of this problem. And that is that this poison flowed through this system for at least, well, it never stopped flowing. We know that it was flowing at 8 o'clock in the morning on the morning of January 9th. And we know that there are people who say that they've been smelling it before that. One. They never shut the system off. It continued to flow through that system and has never to this date been shut off.
Bob, do you happen to know what they use to chlorinate the water?
No, I don't know. I don't know what the standard for chlorination is.
What the standard is. Different things are used to chlorinate it. I'm just wondering if they use chlorine gas or if they switch to chloramine. That's just what everyone's done. The reason being, it didn't flow through pure water. It flowed through chlorinated water. And if they're using chlorine gas with lots of really good reactive free chlorine, some of it probably got chlorinated as well and turned into something really nasty.
Does that account for why formaldehyde is suddenly showing up?
In the testing, that could do it. Yeah.
Bob, I have a question.
Yeah, because
and I have a question for the whole group because I need to know this, and this is related to our discussion. We're talking about this particular instance of a systematic effort on the part of the society and on the part of these companies to poison the water, destroy the environment, and kill people. And my question is, instead of dealing with these problems piecemeal and legal steps that have to do with each individual problem or each individual historical instance of this systemic problem, why can't, is there any other way to deal with the root of this so that we can get rid of this problem altogether so that these people are just absolutely rooted out of the entire these people who happen to be perpetrated this kind of stuff. Excuse me.
Hey, Bob.
Yes.
I'm trying to find that water treatment plant on Google Earth. Do you have any hints to where I look?
Yeah. Once you've gotten to Charleston, West Virginia.
Yeah.
You will see that the Kanawha River flows through Charleston. And you'll see a river intersecting the emptying into the Kanawha. That's the Elk. And if you go back
past the airport.
Oh no! This the water treatment plant is in downtown Charleston.
Okay, so go. There's a looks like it doesn't give me the rivers.
Okay, hang on here.
Is it anywhere near Magic Island?
Yeah, it's a little bit further west of Magic Island.
Yeah, just to add a little note to the discussion, going back a few minutes, You know, I mean, you don't need to have a history of working with plastics like Jason or know about organic chemistry like Wagyu does. You know, anyone with a speck of common sense, if they, you know, see a name as long and as convoluted as that, you know, common sense dictates that stuff ain't good.
Hey, Sparky.
Yeah.
If you do you see the highways? Do you see how 64 and 77 merge?
Yes.
Okay. If you will go north on 77 from that split, West Virginia American Water Company is right there off of right there near it's well, as I'm looking at the map, it is to the south of the interstate. Just, you know, not a mile, barely a mile from that split.
Okay.
So that's, yeah. that's where that is.
Now, Sergi, let me add to what you just said, because if that stuff is caustic to the plastic, and it is actually melting the plastic, you're not just dealing with the chemical itself, you're also dealing with everything that's being released out of the PVC.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And melted PVC. I don't know about you, but I don't think I'd like to drink a cup of melted PVC.
Bob, well, I wanted to finish here and say, instead of trying to document each and every instance of this and trying to prove each and every instance of this stuff that they know that we know that they're doing, I'm sorry to seem impatient, maybe naive and stuff, but why is it that we have to go through the whole process of proving each and every instance? We know historically and systemically that this kind of stuff's been going on, and it's been going on for decades. How is it that we can just root out the whole problem and get rid of these and just change the whole structure of the situation so that this kind of stuff doesn't continue? You know, so we don't have to keep on going over and over and over and over and proving.
Well, one of the essential philosophical, I guess, discussions, but it's also very concrete and very real world, is why we allow for-profit companies to handle essentials of daily living.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I was going to give Larry a quick answer of end capitalism.
Well, I mean, you don't even have to end capitalism altogether, but you have to have... Look... I think it was, it was a private for-profit water company that begins with a V that took over Atlanta's metropolitan water system. And they did it so, they ran it so shoddily that the people of Atlanta said, be gone. Be gone. You're done. And the people took back their fresh water delivery. Why can that not happen here? Why should it not happen here? Because, see, West Virginia American Water's history is one of coming what'll happen is, and, you know, it's interesting how the Republicans call it pork. If we get a water system, a so-called city water system delivered out into rural areas and a public service district is formed, and the federal government provides the money for laying the line, digging the holes, all of that. And part of the reason I ask what the piping was is because I saw the line being laid that brought water here because it was not that many years ago, and it looked like plastic to me. It was kind of a blue-green color. And we don't have a sewer system, so these were water mains. These were delivery lines.
Yeah,
what happens is West Virginia, after taxpayer money has been used to create the water system, West Virginia American sleazes in and says, we can do it better and cheaper than you, and gets the public service district sold to them at fire sale prices. And then people's water bills start going up. Here where I live, we've seen water bills go through the roof over the last 10 years, along with the power bills. And and both of those are on account of the fact that these businesses are run for profit.
And when Chicago sold, when under Richard Daley, when Chicago sold off their parking meters to this outfit, people were inconvenienced by having to pay for parking around the clock on weekends, such that their Polish fests and their Irish fests and their German fests were also billable time to these meter companies. It's the same formula everywhere you look. Everywhere. So,
you know, I've heard about that parking meter situation before, and you know that actually that's a foreign corporation that owns the damn thing.
Yes. It's a scam.
Privatization.
Yeah, it's the same meme everywhere you look. So, your question, Bob, why shouldn't you guys have your a municipal water system or a countywide or state water system? There is no legitimate reason why that shouldn't happen, and especially since water is required for everyone to live.
Hey, Bob, what about using eminent domain?
Yeah, well, it speaks to our surrender to corporate interests.
Yep.
I think you're right in all regards, and I can't form, because A, I'm not a lawyer and I don't play one on the radio, B, I can't express an opinion as to why we can't use eminent domain, but it certainly seems that conceptually eminent domain, this is exactly the kind of thing that eminent domain was designed for. In other words, you have an issue that relates to the overarching good of the public as a whole, and determinations are made that people, that property can be seized as long as a fair market value is paid by government for purposes of advancing the public good. Now, here's a wrinkle in this, and chime in if you wish. What is the fair market value of a useless, poisoned water infrastructure?
A great big negative number.
Bob,
let me chime in a little bit more on that. When in the hell has eminent domain ever been used for that? It's always used to seize property from people to sell it off to private corporations.
Exactly. That's
well, no, I mean, eminent domain has been used for road building purposes. Domain.
Yeah, but that's still the same thing, and largely the same point. It's selling off property, keep your property, my property, to a private company to build the road.
Yeah, but that's a one-time. But Kevin, that's a one-time operation. The private contractor, the road builder, builds the road, and then he's out of the picture. And the public benefits from that road being there. But to your point, I forgot who just spoke before me. But you know, eminent domain has been purloined itself to benefit corporations because they say, well, you know, if we do this operation, there'll be a lot of tax money generated. And so they get their way under the guise of generating a tax revenue for a county or municipality, and that's a subtle twisting of the whole concept of eminent domain, which is supposed to be a seizure of property for the public good, the whole public good. In other words, we're going to seize your property, and it's going and the seizure will create a greater commons.
There's an example out in California, I think it's Richmond, where a Green Party mayor is using it to basically yank properties from the banks and then making it affordable and returning it to the people who live in them so that they can afford to live there without being shoved onto the street.
Those properties have become creeping in as a
technique.
Well, yeah. Grant, it's interesting you would bring up Richmond, California, because the very U.S. Chemical Board plan that would have prevented this disaster was developed as a result of disasters that had transpired in Richmond, California, as a result of Chevron's presence there, I believe, and had been adopted by the government there. And the U.S. Chemical Safety Board took that plan, handed it to the state of West Virginia, said, you've got a lot of similar circumstances here. Please implement this. That was done almost, 3 years to the day before this disaster began. by June of 2011, if I've got my dates right, Governor Earl Ray Tomlin's administration had said, we don't need no stinking plans. Or if that's deemed an unfair characterization, the Tomlin administration said, no thank you.
There's just got to be a way to impeach that guy off of that. I mean, that's just borderline criminal negligence. I don't know.
Borderline? No, I think he crossed that line a long time ago. That train's already left the station.
Right. No, I work sort of up there with soulless whore, I know.
You know, a problem or a program that's very difficult to listen to, Bob, after you go off the air is Rick Smith, because he's so close to New York, and he talks about that stinking, I forget this guy's name, the governor, and what he has done to that state to benefit corporations at the expense of the citizens who are increasingly and incrementally becoming more and more and more impoverished is so disturbing to me that I can barely summon the strength some nights to even listen to this guy beyond a half hour, and so I flip over to Malloy, who has he's got his own agonies, and you talk about this your governor being negligent. These guys are out and out corrupt. They just flat out are, and there's I grew up, I came of age during the Watergate investigation era, and that old follow the money scheme is something that I've grown up with. And when you follow the goddamn money, you can't but conclude that these guys are simply corrupt.
Are you talking about the man so nice they named him twice, Chris Christie?
I'm talking about Scott Walker in Wisconsin. I'm talking about the piece of shit in Florida. I'm talking about Kasich in Ohio. I'm talking about the governor of West Virginia. I'm talking about the governor of Pennsylvania. And you know what? All the other governors that are not quite there are always being tempted and tested and seduced by money. It is such a goddamn corrosive. And none of these big money bastards give a damn about a better democracy or a better republic. It is always about them and their interests and their buddies' interests. I'm reading it's still The Economy Stupid by Paul Begala, who writes in 02 and 03 about George W. Bush. The very first couple of things, first couple of years this guy tried to pull is like a, I mean, it's like a, it's any number of things that this guy was into, even in the first couple of years of his administration. It would make you want to just stick needles in your eyes. It was so nauseating. And we had yet 6 years to go of this son of a bitch. And the investigations about him and his insider trading and his Harkin Energy nonsense and his Arbusto, which is Spanish for Bush Oil Exploration Corporation, and how he got a contract to drill off of Bahrain only on his name because his old man was the president at the time. It is so obvious that these motherfuckers don't give a fuck about anything but themselves. And they never have and they never will. They figured it out. It is all about right now for them. And the earth be damned. I just came across a very good expression. And Bob, maybe it was you last night. The expression is "Earth bats last."
Oh no, that was Dave from Portland brought up that.
Man, that was beautiful.
There's another one, very similar, and that expression is, reality asserts itself.
Well, I'm into that.
Well, with respect to our climate issues, man, every time I talk to someone that gives me the, you know, the dirty look, like, oh, Jesus Christ, and I say, hey, wake up. Look around. What's happening with our winters and our summers and our failure to go from, you know, to flow from winter into spring? All of a sudden, we got an early, you know, the blossoms are blooming on the tree, and we get a couple of goddamn snowstorms up here,
yep,
destroying everything. Figure it out. You know, it's not Earth, it's not the Earth warming at a very warm, you know, gentle, easy pace. It's the extremes and the anomalies. You know, you can't be a moron forever. Get your head out of the sand. And, by the way, these people have children. I don't have any kids. And you know what? Increasingly, I'm glad that I never brought a kid into this world. Because...
Yeah, no, I get it.
Tough, yeah, exactly. You and Malloy and everybody else that I listen to online that has children is so concerned for these youngsters. And everybody that I speak to that has kids or nieces or nephews or grandkids or great-grandchildren, I say, hey, what about them? What about them? Trash that SUV and get a goddamn Prius if you can. Do something. Do anything.
Yeah.
But you... am I wrong?
No.
People think I'm nuts. I mean, this is a... This
no,
is
you're
the
right. They don't buy it.
Right,
the average person doesn't buy it.
Well...
Right on, buddy. Right on.
That's why I write all the dark-ass poetry I do and send it in. Now, some of it gets read. Some of you guys heard it. Some of you guys haven't heard the worst of it.
Yeah, you're...
This is Jay. Am I speaking to Jay?
Yeah.
Yeah, you your Keystone XL poem got read the other night.
Yes. Excellent.
Yeah, I heard that you read it. And by the way, you mentioned the piece of shit in Florida, and you had me Googling. I just realized that the articles out now are saying he's going to spend $100 million to get reelected.
On top of
it,
that's his own money.
Now, the money crowd will pour in the money. The corporates will pull in, push in the money because they're getting to a point where they own everything.
I didn't mean to change the subject on you. I just kind of hit on that. But.
You didn't change the subject. That's the exact subject we're talking about.
Yep.
Whether it's some ignored disaster, this inconvenience in West Virginia, or this, it's a spill. For Christ's sake, you spilled a cup of coffee. For God, you know. It's the language that these people use that tends to diminish their responsibility and obfuscate and mollify the masses that are so damn stuck on Duck Dynasty or some other bullshit. I think Malloy has it right. He said, you know, people aren't going to get out there until the cable is out.
That's me.
That's you?
That's me.
I beg your pardon, Bob.
No.
Okay, I beg your pardon. you guys are all...
We run together.
Yeah, well, you're in a blender, man. You're in a...
Yeah.
But,
you know,
if I don't quote the right party, I do share the information. And,
no worries.
Yeah.
Who was about to say something?
I was just about to say, you know, I forget where it was, maybe AATTP, but they had a thing about someone came out and said what Democrats are doing wrong, and the gist of the article was that Republicans are focusing on emotional issues, while Democrats tend to lean more toward the more thinking issues, I guess you'd say. And that's so true, because to all these teabaggers have got it down. If they keep people focused on the emotional issues of God, gays, and guns, they're too busy paying attention to the water being poisoned or their air being polluted or what Rick Scott is doing to Florida, that kind of thing. And
hey, Kevin,
you know,
I mentioned a month or so ago about my deep respect for a guy by the name of Chris Hedges. He yep. focuses on exactly that. One of his contentions is that American politics has just become a spectacle, a circus spectacle, where you'll vote for, excuse me, you'll vote for the good-looking guy, the glib guy, the guy with the charisma, but not the guy with the any ideas that are going to help you. And that's precisely what you just described. You know, it's sunk to such a disgusting level of an absence of any cerebral interaction between what your needs and what the candidates are saying. And it's terrifically. Go ahead.
Dan, I'm sorry to interrupt, but this just generally goes to the heart of the fact that anyone, you know, and I'm going to make this broad generalization.
Yeah.
Anyone who's running for political office or anybody in government, yep. it seems that they have the utmost disdain for people out here and people that they provide programs and service to. And I'm making general comment, and it seems that and after they make a boo-boo, when they actually talk amongst themselves and they say something and they reveal how much disdain that they have for the people, then when people hear it, then they get back to the, then when they know that they're being heard, then they offer some disclaimer. Oh no, we didn't mean that, but it seems that we all know that if you expect a corporate business, some businesses run for profit, or some government entity that has to operate within this economic system, they're going to treat the people that they serve. I mean, they're just going to have disdain. So I don't know why, you know, and Chris Hedges is right. It's been that way for probably since the political system began and since the country began. It is the same thing all over the world.
Yes, I agree with your I agree with your reaction to what I had to say. Who am I speaking to?
That's Larry.
Larry.
Dan, this is Larry from Berkeley, California.
Good to talk to you, Larry. Yeah, you know, and this guy has stated with some clarity that the people that gravitate toward politics are at best mediocre and at worst venal. And when he says venal, he uses George W. Bush and Dick Cheney as examples. And I absolutely agree with that. He said, you know, he has stated that these guys, they can't make it in private life that they extol for the rest of us. They are at least narcissists of the highest order.
Amen.
Sociopaths. And there's a book out there. It's called The Psychopath Test. That's the name of that's the title of the book. The Psychopath Test is a book designed to be read, but it determines whether or not, for example, someone is suited for Wall Street trading. In other words, you have to be a heartless son of a bitch to function and survive and be an asset to your corporation on Wall Street, because you have to be a bastard. And it shouldn't surprise anybody listening to me right now that is true. That's the world they live in. How about those people that laughed at the Occupy folks down there on the sidewalk, you know, while they drank their champagne and snorted their coke at their parties? Someone told me that recently. Someone told me that it's the blah people, and I'm deliberately quoting Santorum. It's the blah people, you know, because they're all in jails. And I said to her, I said, okay, so these people are targeted, you know, the stop and search thing, the stop and frisk thing, and I said, how about if they stopped and frisked the people on Wall Street? What do you think they'd find in their pockets? Because that's where the real that's where the real big dope money is. We've all heard about their parties. We know that they exist. And I'm all for, you know, young people having fun. But God damn it, when kids on the street, because of their attire and their skin color, are being rousted by the cops. And forced to do so, by the way, by their superiors, which goes right to Bloomberg. It is not unlike what the GIs in Vietnam had to do for their superiors, which is to kill everything that literally everything that moved. And I'm referring to Nick Turse's book, "Kill Everything."
That's
that
been
moved.
Going on since the '60s. You dirty, stinking hippie.
Yeah. Oh yeah. I know.
And Nixon.
I know.
Harry, before you get too far away from Chris Hedges, Dan, have you seen the one on YouTube, the new one, the Chris Hedges at Moravian College?
Where he was booed off the stage?
No. No, he got a standing ovation and took a lot of questions.
I did not. I have not seen that.
YouTube it. Chris Hedges, Moravian College. That's a pretty powerful speech he gave.
Yeah.
And I'll shut up now.
You know, virtually, I'm a huge fan of this guy. Virtually everything that he does is powerful. And, you know, my first introduction to Hedges was based on a recommendation by a friend of mine who said, you know, if you don't know this guy, you should familiarize yourself. So I found him online. And I either went to YouTube or read some of the stuff, but it was so powerful that I had to back off for a couple of months because he was so
correct.
Yes. God damn it. Yes.
Well, and
I thought, oh my God, if this guy is, you know, if he's telling me,
Chris Hedges is brilliant. I might add as an aside here that he spoke at one of the incarnations of the Seneca II lecture series down in the Kanawha Valley, oddly enough.
Okay.
And it was and we carried it on the horn back then.
Mm.
And it was as a result, during that discussion that Chris Hedges looked out at the assembled audience, and it was pretty much packed house. It was down at West Virginia State University, which is this state's historically black college, which sits right next to Bayer Crop Sciences, where they 5 years ago nearly had a Bhopal scale disaster because they stored methyl isocyanate on the site. Naturally, that's, you know, we allow chemical companies to come in and plop down next to our state's historical black college, but that's another issue. But Hedges said, of all the people in the United States who are put upon, he said, the people who are subjected to having to deal with mountaintop removal have an absolute right to take up arms and begin defending themselves against these coal companies.
Yeah, yeah.
And he went on and he said that they have not is a testament to their fortitude and their commitment to maintaining civil society. And he's absolutely right. He is.
You know,
what do you do? What do you do when you know that there is an industry working right next door to your home that is poisoning your loved ones and is doing so intentionally and willfully and without regard to human health or human rights? What do you do?
Yeah.
And for profit.
Yeah, and they're just doing it for money. The whole smoke screen of when Joe Manchin says, well, West Virginia's done the heavy lifting for America, and we don't mind getting our hands dirty. You know what?
Fuck him.
I get a little tired of this business about how some sacrifices are going to have to be made, and the sacrifice is worthwhile, because I can't help noting that every time somebody talks about the sacrifice being worthwhile, it's somebody who isn't dead. Now, I know that may sound a little crazy, you know, dead men tell no tales.
It isn't them.
Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, you're just another ticking time bomb there, Bob.
Well,
going back to an earlier point about, you know, the type of people who are attracted to politics, I'd say that's mostly true. However, and I can speak with a little authority on this since I am a staffer for the Tarrant County chapter of the Democratic Party, there are occasionally genuine people who run for office. Like, you know, I've met Wendy Davis, and she seems pretty genuine. But it is true for the most part that it is sociopaths and psychopaths attracted to politics.
Sergi,
well, you know, those are just the ones that are in the revolving door that got into politics because it was the next best move for them to do for their interests in for-profit corporations. The people that get into politics for genuine reasons actually do care about people. But, I mean, you know, you gotta look. Just follow the money. You'll see.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, that's the impression I get from Wendy, and there's, you know, there's a whole slate of candidates we have running. Like, there's this, and, you know, I've noticed that, you know, the truly genuine, actually, that makes me think of a really good point just now. The really genuine people in politics, because, you know, there's a lot of people who start off in corporate worlds or, you know, whatever, and then, oh, look, I'm running for House of Representatives, or I'm running for a senator, or I'm running for governor. The genuine people, they start off in local elections. You know, Wendy Davis, before she was a state senator, now she's running for governor, she was on the Fort Worth City Council. You know.
Well, I gotta ask, if you're interested in social change and you want to do activism as opposed to doing politics, and I'm more interested right now in doing activism, and I think that's a noble calling, then how do you root your talents and your the best aspects of your personality into something and be involved as an activist without having to worry about being politically connected with organized politics?
I don't understand that question at all.
Well, you know, Larry, I think I got it. Well, one thing, I'm going to go back to Chris Hedges one time and some of the things that he was saying to the Green Party. He was suggesting the most subversive or effective thing that we can do is build a parallel sort of logistical system. Food, clothing, shelter, whatever you can do, you know, locally. It seems like that's what he was pointing to as something that just as an underpinning. It's like in the old days with a strike. Well, if you're going to have a strike, you got to have support for the strike, got to have food, people got to have Franks and weenie, you know, Franks and beans, and that kind of thing has to happen. And I think about that in our terms. You know, what can we do? Now, we're scattered everywhere, but no matter where we live, there's usually something that you can do to just go total local on your support system. That in and of itself decouples you from dependency on a lot of the oligarchic systems. It's slow at first. It doesn't seem like it's much. But over time, if you keep that trajectory, I think you'll see a significant independence from them. And that's a position of power. You can bargain from that position. At least that's what I think.
Sergi, did you understand my question based upon how Grant answered my question? Or understand what I was saying because you had a hard time understanding what I was asking?
I'm still trying to process it.
All right. Can someone rephrase what I just – well, anyway, so that Sergi can – I'd just like to find a way without having to deal with the political institutions to do political work. I'd like to bypass the mainstream political system to be able to do good political work and be able to get things done if I can. That's all.
I think that's
entirely understandable, and I just want to throw something out for general consideration. I want, at the close of every Friday on the front porch, I try to thank everybody for their participation. But these last two Fridays on the front porch have been, to my ear and my mind, something extraordinary. They have been a proof of a concept that is not being tried anywhere else. There is not a millionaire in our group there is not someone who is under contract to professionally say smart stuff in this entire group. And yet, the opinions and the facts and the arguments that are being put forward within this group are worth far more than any millionaire pundit has ever offered. Real solutions are being discussed here from some of the esoterically grounded queries that Larry is making to the real hard and fast concrete stuff that that Waggy and Jay Cruzen have brought forward to Dan's arguments, to the observations that Kevin has made, to Bill, to the broad perspective that Bill brings. I'm just sitting here listening, and I am absolutely transfixed by all of this. And I guess the question I'm asking is, why cannot this, and I don't mean this, me, egomaniac, but why cannot this model of American people trying to solve problems of the people, by the people, and for the people, not become the dominant mode of discussion in this country? And I would hope that because, you know, okay, we're doing something nobody else is doing. Maybe it'll catch on. Because this isn't happening anywhere else that I'm aware of. And so, you know, I want to give the big clap to all of y'all for what you bring to this. I want to throw a couple of quotes out real quick, too, because I got one of I just got one of our buddy Harry's very, very trenchant emails. He's pulled up some quotes, and they are quotations from Karl Marx from 1844 from an essay called The Power of Money. Now, I know, I just said the cultural and political equivalent of Beetlejuice to a wide swath of the American public. Here, let's go ahead and get it over with. Karl Marx. There, I've said it three times. Okay? But the fact of the matter is, the man remains one of the most incisive analysts of money culture, consumer culture, capitalist culture, who has ever drawn breath. And he said the following, and I think this goes to something that was said a couple of moments ago. By possessing the property of buying everything, by possessing the property of appropriating all objects, money is thus the object of eminent possession. The universality of its property is the omnipotence of its being. It is therefore regarded as an omnipotent being. Money is the procurer between man's need and the object, between his life and his means of life. But that which mediates my life for me also mediates the existence of other people for me. For me, it is the other person. Then this. If money is the bond binding me to human life, binding society to me, binding me and the nature, and nature and man, is not money the bond of all bonds? Can it not dissolve and bind all ties? Is it not, therefore, the universal agent of separation? Money then appears as this distorting power, both against the individual and against the bonds of society, which claim to be entities in themselves. It transforms fidelity into infidelity, love into hate, hate into love, virtue into vice, vice into virtue, servant into master, master into servant, idiocy into intelligence, and intelligence into idiocy. Since money as the existing and active concept of value confounds and confuses all things, it is the general confounding and confusing of all things, the world upside down, the confounding and confusing of all natural and human qualities. I mean, can we chisel that into some tablets and hang it in some schoolways? Oh, no, because Jesus wouldn't love us anymore, right?
That is profound. Yeah.
Got some real live, honest-to-goodness resonance going on there, doesn't it?
You
And thanks very much to Harry for digging that out and sending it along. By the way, I don't know where Friday on the front porch or Friday in the fetal position, depending on how you tend to look at things. I don't know where these things go, because this is absolutely roared by. And I do thank you all. I would like to mention that we have had some help this evening, and I'm very grateful to Sal and to Asa and Kevin and to Jack for helping with this evening's fundraising. We find ourselves at $240 to go to finish out the week to the good, and any help that anybody wants to kick in is much welcome. And I'm not just talking to I'm not talking specifically to the chat group here. I'm talking to the larger Horn family commune as a whole. This is certainly no valedictory, but the things that y'all have brought up and talked about are going to be swirling through my head tomorrow as I fly from here to Atlanta and Atlanta to New York. I'm still a little bit astounded by the fact that I've been invited up there. It blows my mind. Who am I kidding? But it does not blow my mind when I realize the tremendous intellect and the real genius that is brought to bear on problems by you guys. Because whatever it is that we do here is a function of conversation and not of pontification. And I think that right there is the dividing line between the kind of problem solving that we would like to do here versus the kind of problem solving, which is not even problem solving at all, that takes place at places like Radio TV Rwanda and the right wing hatosphere writ large. I've got a blinking light here and very little time in which to deal, but I want everybody to get a chance to talk. Is there anybody who would care to vacate one of their spaces so I can bring another person in on the phone?
Bob, I'll vacate.
All right, that'll be fine. Thank you very kindly, and y'all, and do have a good weekend, please.
Okay, Bob. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right, let's see who we have here. Hey, welcome to the program.
Bob, can you hear me?
I can.
Oh, good. It's Roger in Minneapolis.
Hey, Roger.
How you doing?
Good.
Tried to get through using the Skype, but seemed to have some technical difficulties, so this works. Listening to the show tonight, a few things crossed my mind that I haven't been able to voice immediately. The matter of using this symbolic representation of value that we call money, which is really a figment of our own imaginations that we enforce with guns and coercion, or just groupthink. It's really very, very interesting to look at the immense foment of examination of that question that occurred around the time that Marx was writing, and a little bit later, a little bit earlier.
Yeah, the mid-19th century European Revolution.
Yeah, I've translated literally about 2,000 pages of works on value theory from German into English, mostly from that era, and gotten a chance to really get a good look at what a lot of these people were thinking. And the distorting power of coming up with an abstraction like money to represent value was recognized by a great many of them as a critical and utter flaw in human construct. And we're getting the results of it. So
I think so. And I think it... I don't think that's by accident, Roger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not new, Bob. You know?
Yeah.
When Simon Cameron was Secretary of War, he was buying uniforms for the Union soldiers that were dissolving in the rain.
I was thinking that exact thing that melted in the first rain.
Profit chasing has been around since the beginnings of mankind.
Anybody who would enjoy a humorous take on that would do well to go and read Twain's "The Facts in the Great Beef Contract." It's one of those that'll make your sides hurt. You laugh so hard, but there's a reality to it that cannot be denied. We do now find ourselves at the time of having to bail out because our time is at an end. I do want to extend my thanks again to everybody who's participated this evening. Dan and Bill and Roger and everybody in the Horn Malloy Skype chat group, Sparky and Larry and Waggy and Roger and Jay Cruz and Grant and Sergi, you've all been absolutely wonderful, and you really do because I sit here and maybe if I'm overreacting, you know, I don't mean to, but I'm sitting here contemplating not just this disaster, but the other disasters that have been unfolding long before anybody gave a damn. Or before many people gave a damn, because there's a lot of people who do give a damn, and most all of us have not been listened to, and it's deeply inspiring to have y'all sort of putting things in perspective. I really appreciate all of you, and so with any luck at all, it'll be More End Monday come Monday evening, and of course this evening at roughly midnight, 12:05 Eastern Time. The Horn Malloy Skype chat group will fire up again for its usual weekly Friday night Chattapalooza, hosted by the indefatigable Sparky. So thank you, Sparky. Yeah.
Say hello to Tara if you meet up with her for us all.
I sure will. I absolutely will, and I know she'll holler howdy back. So thanks everybody.
She's been in our group before.
Oh yeah, she's great. She's simply great.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm clearing off the phone lines. And Skype group, good night. And thanks to our all volunteer staff. Thank you for a kind anonymous donation that has taken our deficit down to $190 for the end of the week. Thank you very kindly. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff, Lottie and Sparky and Texas Betsy in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas, Gene and Susan. Thank you to Ben Birch. Thank you to John Fox. Thank you to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net, and acact.org. And always, always, always. Gina, it's all for you. Have a great weekend, everybody. Rick Smith is next on the Horn.